This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega. And welcome to The Takeaway's 4th of July special. To begin, we're going to revisit a conversation I had about wealth disparities between white and black families in this country. Take a listen. Now here's something you might not know. When I'm not guest hosting The Takeaway during summer break, I'm busy at my day job as a college professor. And today, we are indulging my professorial impulses by starting with a pop quiz.
What?
I promise, just three questions. Are you ready? Okay. Now, the first question is multiple choice. For every $1 of wealth held by a typical white family, about how much wealth is held by a typical black family? Is it A, 70 cents to the dollar? B, 50 cents to the dollar? Or C, 12 cents to the dollar? Got your answer? Okay. Now, here's the next question. True or false? Getting a college degree is the best way for Black and Latinx families to close the racial wealth gap. All right, stick with me. We're almost done. The last question is also multiple choice. Based on extensive research, which of these public policies would be the most effective tool for narrowing racial wealth gaps? Is it A, tax incentives to promote marriage? B, to increase the mortgage interest deduction for homeowners? C, increase the minimum wage? Or D, baby bonds? Pencils down, everyone. And with me now to give us the answers and help us make sense of them are my guests. First, we've got Dorian Warren, co-president of Community Change and co-founder of the Economic Security Project. He's also my co-host of System Check. Dorian, great to have you back.
Great to be back with you, Melissa. I'm eager for this pop quiz. I have some answers.
Look, I'm telling you, I know you do. And we're also joined by Aisha Yonduro, who is CEO of Springboard to Opportunities, a Mississippi-based nonprofit providing direct support to residents of affordable housing. Aisha, I'm so happy to have you here.
Hi, France. Great to be here with you all.
So Dorian, let me come to you on that. Let's go back up to that first question. Just how big is the racial wealth gap? Is it 70 cents on the dollar, 50 cents on the dollar, or 12 cents on the dollar of black families to white families?
Melissa, I'm going to go with 12 cents on the dollar. And I actually think that's too high, depending on which study you look at. It could be 7 cents on the dollar, but it's nowhere near 50 cents or 70 cents. We know that for sure.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. You're exactly right. I'm not surprised. Ding, 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 right? It's 12 cents on the dollar at best, right? As you point out, and has in fact, let's just go for a follow-up extra credit here, hasn't been growing or shrinking over recent decades.
Well, my guess would be it's shrinking. And I think we have some data. If you go back just over a decade to the Great Recession, we know that during that economic downturn, white families' wealth fell about 26%. But the wealth of black families fell by 48%. And for Latinx families, 45%. So given the pandemic we have been living through over the last year and this even worse economic downturn, I would suspect, so you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that the gap is actually increasing.
All right. So Aisha, you sort of inspired some of this because the last time we talked, you gave me a pop quiz about what is the price of milk. Question number two, is college education the best way to close the racial wealth gap?
My answer is false.
Why?
You know, I think that we have enough data that show that Black women are the highest educated in our demography as it relates to associate's degrees and bachelor degrees and graduate degrees. But when we are talking about the wealth gap in the economy, they are still at the bottom because with wealth inequities and a lot of those realities. So I think that college education is still a myth that we tell ourselves as a way to go about closing the wealth gap. But I really think that's false.
Yes, ding, ding, ding. That's right. That is false because although it has a big impact on income, as you were just talking about, it doesn't have a great impact on wealth. It turns out wealth is a lot stickier than income, which we're going to start digging into. Gosh, y'all are so good at this. All right, final question, and I'll let you both in on this one. I offered some possibilities for policies that could make a big difference. Marriage incentives, higher mortgage interest deductions, raising the minimum wage, or issuing baby bonds. Which one of you wants to take answering that one for closing the wealth gap?
You know, I'll start first. So my answer, I was like, this is really a pop quiz. And because I was like, you know, I could go with either the third or the fourth option with this one, but I'm going to stay on brand and advocate for cash without restrictions. So I'm going to say baby bonds. And what that is, just to, you know, do some level setting, a baby bond would be every child receives a publicly funded trust account at birth and is aimed at decreasing the wealth gap, and the amount that individuals receive at birth would be dependent upon on the income levels of their families. So it's, you know, it's cash for families without restrictions. And I'm an advocate for that. So I'm going to go with baby bonds.
Dorian, you want to get in on this one?
I want to get in on this one because Aisha stole my thunder. So I was going to say baby bonds too. But how about this, Melissa? I'm going to add a fifth option, and that is power. Power to change the rules, the norms, and the practices that extract wealth, particularly from Black families. And that's about organizing and voting and all the things that changes the rules of our country that have led us to this condition of a wealth gap. It's intentional policy choices. And we can make other choices, as Aisha just said, in terms of baby bonds is one example.
All right, so Dorian Warren and Aisha Andor are both very much on brand today, and I think are giving us both the right answers, although Dorian is, of course, going outside the margins and giving us an answer that wasn't an option. But that's right. It turns out the raising the minimum wage would be great, again, for closing income gaps, but not for wealth gaps. So Dorian, let me go to you on this, just as Aisha said, to kind of level set a little bit. Make sure everybody's on the same page about what the difference is between an income gap and a racial wealth gap.
So an income gap is when, you know, you might be working full time. I think, you know, for instance, of my sister-in-law who works as a cook at Whole Foods and struggles to make ends meet because she has volatile hours every week. She doesn't make that much. And so when it comes at the end of the month, rent, utilities, things for her baby, it's a stretch. And we know that over half of Americans don't have $400 for an emergency. Now that's the pivot to wealth, because what wealth is more like insurance. It's there, it's a buffer for when you come on the hard times, you can draw from wealth to help cover an unexpected expense. And for those that have wealth, it is also a form of investment. You can invest in yourself. You can invest in your family. And so we have to close for sure the income gap, and especially the income gap between women of color and particularly white men. That's like the floor. But we have to go further and say, okay, but what is the wealth that people have, and what are the wealth building policies so that people can afford an emergency expense or an unexpected expense, or they can invest in their child's education in terms of college or whatever it might be.
So I love the language you used of wealth being like insurance. I sometimes think of it as like how puffy is the mattress that you're going to fall back on, right, when things go bad. If it's real thin, you still might, right, get hurt if you fall down. But if it's nice and puffy, right, if you've got plenty of wealth there, even if it's not like billionaire wealth, but if it's, you know, if there's something good, if there's a cushion, then when you fall, it's going to hurt a lot less. Now, Aisha, I want to talk with you a little bit about that kind of cushion, because the programs and folks who you work with have very little cushion, really no cushion at all. Talk to me about the women who are part of the programs that you work with and why you are, to be on brand, an advocate for cash without restrictions.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. And you're exactly right. There is no cushion for the individuals that we work with at Springboard Opportunities. On average, our families are making about $12,000 annually. And this goes to really what Doreen was saying. They are working, but they're working jobs that are very volatile. And they're also working in jobs where, you know, they're now considered essential, but we're not paying them as if they're essential. So here in Mississippi, our minimum wage, federal minimum wage, is still $7.25 an hour. So we have individuals working full times at that rate, and that doesn't allow you to not build a cushion, let alone to getting to wealth, let alone to just having income stability. So we are seeing the individuals that we work with working tirelessly and not having the bandwidth to actually begin to think about power building or wealth building or those pieces, because they are caught in the trap of just survival. And so in order to address that need, which is a very real need of making sure that you just have the resources, is to tend to your day-to-day pieces of your life based on what it is that you're saying that you need it. We launched the Magnolia Mothers Trust a few years ago. And what the Magnolia Mothers Trust is, it's a guaranteed income project that we started in 2018. And it provides $1,000 a month for 12 months, no strings attached, to extremely low-income Black mothers that live in federally subsidized affordable housing. And for us, it was so important to center the needs on Black women because we recognize, you know, if we're talking about wealth inequities within this country, so much of the inequalities that we've seen have been shouldered majorly by Black women with our income disparities, with our wealth gap, with the way in which we roll out resources. And we wanted to say, you know, what would it look like if we put Black women in the center of joy and liberation and not so much pain and degradation, which is a lot of times the narrative in which this population has to live out.
So I love that, want to connect it back to Dorian's point about power, right? And this idea that, which, you know, again, you've sort of moved us to this whole other space of thinking about how we engage as citizens, as residents in the context of a democracy to change the rules of the game. So Dorian, maybe talk to us a little bit about how middle-class wealth, right, full stop, in fact, got built initially as a result of power and choices made by citizens in government.
Well, I'll give you two quick examples, Melissa. A federal policy that in many ways built white wealth in this country and extracted Black wealth. So if you go back to right after World War II, and there's plenty of political science and historical research on this, the federal government advanced very low interest loans, but excluded Black folk. So an FHA loan, if you were white and you were working class or low income, you get that loan, buy a house, build your wealth, Black folks excluded. And then you add in that whole housing industry with and the rules that structured the housing industry. So redlining that kept Black families out of particular neighborhoods where they could have built wealth. That was federally sponsored legislation. Or I know we've been talking about education a little bit. It's not the magic bullet, but the GI Bill. The GI Bill for veterans that came back from World War II and other wars and other conflicts, access to essentially free higher education that Black folks were also excluded from. So those are just two of many examples. I could go on, Melissa. We could add in the criminal justice system and mass incarceration, fines and fees in terms of local policing. It's wealth extracting, particularly from Black communities. And so these are government policies. And policies are always choices. They're always choices. And so we can make different choices. And that's what I mean by power in terms of civic engagement and having the power to change the rules, the norms, the practices that have extracted wealth from Black and Latinx communities and have benefited white communities.
Are these the plans that are going to make the difference in the racial wealth gap?
There's got to be more. It's a good start. It's a good start. So we heard just this month that the Biden administration has promised to take action to address racial discrimination in the housing market. And we've talked about housing as one of several pathways to build wealth. And we know that housing has been such a source, particularly housing discrimination by the industry, of wealth extraction and preventing particularly Black families from building wealth. So it's a good start. But Melissa, there's no magic bullet here. We need all the options on the table. So, you know, universal healthcare. We know Black and brown people are more likely to hold jobs that don't offer healthcare or paid sick leave, risking them losing their jobs. And then people get bogged down with medical debt or student debt. We know that Black college graduates owe an average of $25,000 more in student loan debt. We can cancel student loan debt.
Can the church just say amen on student loan debt? Okay, thank you.
Exactly. And then just to toss out one more, public goods. We have grown up in the last 40 years with this notion that somehow the private market is better at providing public goods than government. And that is just false. So if you take childcare, for instance, everybody should have access to high quality, affordable childcare. As a country, we have made the choice not to do that. Now, we can make a different choice in this moment. But imagine if parents, and particularly working class and middle class parents, didn't have to pay for childcare. That's more money that they could use to build wealth. So there are a range. And again, this is, I'm just name checking three of probably 18 different policies that will get at the roots of the racial wealth gap. It's not just about closing the racial wealth gap. It's about getting at the roots of how the gap comes to be in the first place.
So Aisha, I want to come to you because the one piece, one of the reasons I really wanted you here in this conversation is, on the one hand, we can look at the power of public policy, federal and state, to make these kinds of policy differences that Dorian is talking about. But I also have always been a little suspicious of, a little worried about the ways that sometimes government-based programs and interventions also come with all of these moral, ethical strings, these assumptions about who people living in poverty are or how that help ought to come with some rules associated with it. So Aisha, talk to me about the other piece of this, which feels to me like how to also ensure that folks who are on the receiving ends of these policies are empowered to make the choices in order to build their own wealth.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for that. And that's the reality of it. So much of the federal support in a lot of instances comes with restrictions. It's punitive. Our social safety net is very punitive. And what that means is that every time that you have an advancement in one area, there is an immediate decrease in other areas. And we have gotten to the place with the American people that we tie into that narrative that that's the way the system has to work. And it's also tied to this ideal of deservedness. Who deserves all of those pieces that Dorian was just talking about as it relates to decreasing the wealth gap? And the reality is we associate poverty with moralism. We believe that individuals should be working, built into this narrative of dignity as it relates to work and working really hard, and that we have to put these restrictions and these limitations on how all of these services are utilized, because poor people, is what we tell ourselves, do not know how to utilize the resources that they are given. So we feel as if we have to police these resources and tell them what it is that they need and how it is that they should use these services. And that's not the reality of it. The reality is that if we were to give individuals the resources that they need to not only support their immediate needs for themselves and their families, that will also lead to the greater outcomes in this power dynamic that we were talking about. And individuals will have the bandwidth in order to show up and be engaged in their local community in a way that's necessary to really seed community change and movement building. But without that, individuals are caught in a constant cycle of just having to survive. And if you are caught in that constant cycle of having to survive, where do you have the bandwidth to show up to your city council meeting or your school board meeting or to engage in any of the plethora of political movements that are necessary in order to get to effective change that's sustained? And so, you know, just as if we know that the systems, how we have them, have been designed in a certain way based on this narrative of deservedness, we can redesign that. We can have conversations about why it's important that we don't allow these governors to take away the unemployment benefits. We can design these systems in a way of how do we go about centering the conversations and the needs around those who are most impacted and making sure that they have the loudest voice and a lot of these pieces that are necessary to affect change. And right now we're not seeing that. We're seeing that the narrative is continuing along this deficit narrative based on this idea that individuals will use resources in a way that is not aligned to what it is that they need or that we have to police the resources.
I mean, that really just goes right to the heart of the reasons that I included some of those not accurate answers, like marriage, for example. Sometimes we'll hear that if people just get married, it will, you know, solve all of those wealth gap problems. And certainly two incomes help with rearing kids. But we can also see from the data that an African-American household with two incomes still has less wealth than a white household rearing children with one income. And something very similar happens around college education. Black households that are headed by someone with a completed college degree actually have less wealth than the households that are headed by white Americans who simply have a high school diploma. Here's the very last few seconds. If you had one thing you could change to help the wealth gap, what would it be? Dorian?
I would say make the rich people who don't pay taxes, and organize to change the rules.
Aisha?
Organize to change the rules, guaranteed income for everybody.
Dorian Warren and Aisha Yonduro. Y'all, this is why I love my friends. Dorian Warren is the co-president of Community Change and co-founder of the Economic Security Project, and Aisha Yonduro is the CEO of Springboard to Opportunities. Check her out down in Mississippi. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks so much, Melissa. Great to be with you and Aisha for this conversation.
Thank you both so much. This is a great conversation.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina, and this is The Takeaway. Last month, we talked about the FDA's approval of a new drug to treat Alzheimer's disease, and we discussed the search for effective treatments to slow the cognitive decline associated with the disease. Many of you shared your own stories of loved ones who have suffered from Alzheimer's.
My name is Marceline Brown, calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. It's frustrating, my mother's Alzheimer's. She isn't aware of her significant short-term memory loss. She's paranoid, believes people are going in her assisted living apartment, unlocking her door, moving things around so she can't find them. We even put a camera in her apartment to prove it isn't true, and she finds paranoid, delusional excuses around that too, because she simply doesn't remember what she's done or doing. I'm cautiously optimistic for future patients with this drug, but it's too late for my mom. I'm sad and frustrated.
Hi, I'm Lisa from Staten Island, New York, and I just said goodbye to my sister today, who's visiting from Chicago, and we're talking about our mother who died with dementia at 65. She had a lot of other problems. And my sister always says she did not have Alzheimer's, although there was never an autopsy. And I know she had vasculitis that led to dementia, but I think it's fascinating that even though she was married to a doctor and there was enough technology 20 years ago to figure it out, that we're still arguing about what caused her dementia. So I just remarked on that, and also the fact that I have a daughter with spinal muscular atrophy, and I know that if there was an experimental drug like there seems to be for Alzheimer's, that I would be trying it. I'd be in the front row trying to use that drug.
Yeah, my name is Susan Moreno, and I'm calling from Woodbury, New Jersey. My mother died of Alzheimer's on June 15, 2013, at the age of 39. She probably had it for about 8 years. The thing that was the most cool about it was watching her evaporate. This disease is heartless, and she just literally evaporated. I can't even remember the good memories I have of her. I just have that period. I can't get to those memories for her. It's a horrible thing.
My name is Helene from Davie, Florida. My mother has Alzheimer's. She was diagnosed in 2010. My experience, along with hers, has been awful. So many caregivers who don't care, and so many specialized ALS that are specialized in poor care. Caregiving, even if it is just managing care, is draining. There is no hope. It is a disease that kills you, but your body is still here. My mother is now in what I hope is a great facility. But if I get a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or any related disorder, I plan on ending things on my own terms. I may not know what is going on, but I refuse to let my children suffer.
My grandmother was diagnosed with dementia, and we lived with and took care of her for about 8 years. The last 2 years were terrible. She was often confused or scared. She also had bladder cancer, which took its toll. She ended up passing last year, but none of the medications that we used with her seemed to help.
Thanks so much for sharing with us. We always love to hear from you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Next up, we're going to listen to a conversation Lizzie O'Leary had about the lack of routine health screenings during the pandemic that led to cancer being undiagnosed and untreated.
As more and more people get vaccinated against COVID-19, we're also learning of other illnesses they did not catch due to the COVID-19 pandemic. A new report from ProPublica has documented a rising number of people diagnosed with cancer, particularly more advanced stages of cancer. And it's not that more people are getting cancer. It's just that the COVID-19 pandemic prevented many people from being diagnosed earlier. It's an effect that's been felt by lots of different people, but it's particularly acute in communities of color. And the lack of preventative care may have repercussions for years to come. Joining me now is Dua El-Deeb, an investigative reporter for ProPublica who wrote the story. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So can you break down for us sort of what happened with preventative cancer screenings and treatments last year when the pandemic started?
Sure. So this story is really about what happened when we weren't looking, when we were all focused on COVID. So immediately after the pandemic hit, preventative cancer screenings dropped by as much as 94% across the country. So chemo and radiation were suspended or delayed. And in addition to people not getting their mammograms or colonoscopies, people also weren't going to the doctor. So if they were feeling symptoms, normally they would schedule an appointment with their primary care doctor or go to the clinic. That also wasn't happening. So all of that combined led to this drop in diagnoses, in some cases by more than 50%. And that was kind of the backdrop to what we're seeing now.
Yeah, it sounds like it's an issue both of people not doing regular screening, but then you also had these delays in procedures that were sort of pushed off, especially during the early days of the pandemic. Did you learn anything about kind of the consequences of those delays?
Yeah. So at the beginning, you know, remember the messaging was don't come into the hospital, you know, unless you're very, very sick. Let's conserve resources, save them for the people with COVID. And even after that messaging shifted a bit, people were still afraid to go in. And so now looking at the aftermath, what we see are people have now started to return to the hospital and to their doctors, but they're coming in with more advanced cancers. And typically the way that it works with cancer is, you know, the earlier the diagnosis, the sooner treatment starts, the better the outcomes. But now, unfortunately, the effects are going to be long lasting. So the National Cancer Institute has predicted almost 10,000 excess deaths over the next decade from breast and colorectal cancer alone because of pandemic-related delays in diagnosis and treating those cancers.
And breast cancer is one of those particular kinds of cancers where if caught early, you know, a lot can be done. I was struck by something in your story that highlighted the disproportionate burden of breast cancer, particularly later stage breast cancer, on Latino women.
Yes, and that's what's so frustrating about this story. During the pandemic, what we saw was that the pandemic exacerbated a lot of, you know, structural racism that had been built into our healthcare system. And so, you know, people of color, communities of color were hit hardest. And, you know, before the pandemic, Black Americans were already dying of all cancers combined at a higher rate than any other racial group. Latino Americans, you know, cancer was the leading cause of death for Latinos. And like you said, breast cancer specifically for women. And now looking at the impact of the pandemic on cancer care, those same communities are expected to be hit particularly hard.
Dua, you wrote about this woman, Teresa Rubalcaba, in your story, and her story just floored me. Tell me a little bit about her.
So Teresa is a 48-year-old factory worker and mother who spent almost half her life working at the same Chicago candy factory. She loves her three children. She loves her job. And that's why when the pandemic hit and many of us were able to work from home, she kept working at the factory. She was afraid of losing her job. She was afraid of falling again behind on her mortgage, not being able to provide for her family. And she was also afraid of going to the doctor or the ER in the middle of a pandemic. So she ignored her symptoms. You know, she was saying that her right breast was swelling and she was so embarrassed that somebody at the work might notice. So she started stuffing her left side of her bra so no one would notice. Mm-hmm. And she grew more tired and her breast was growing more and more inflamed, but she kept going into work until one day it just got to be too much. And so she said, okay, I'm going to take time off of work. I'm going to schedule a telehealth visit and then I'll, you know, be back at work the next day. And she did that visit, but the doctor couldn't examine her in person. She examined her through a computer screen and she told her, oh, it looks like an infection. Here are some antibiotics. And of course, it wasn't an infection. The antibiotics didn't work. And so she ended up at the emergency room of Mount Sinai Hospital in Chicago, where she met the oncologist, Dr. Khosla, and she was later diagnosed with stage 4 inflammatory breast cancer.
You have a description in your story of Dr. Khosla examining Teresa and that her breast felt like the skin of an orange, that it was something that Dr. Khosla doesn't even see that often because usually things don't get that far.
Right. And inflammatory breast cancer in general is a rare type of breast cancer. And for it to get to this point was something that Dr. Khosla, she said she hadn't seen it this severe in about a decade.
Mm. What do you think Teresa's story tells us about the sort of life of essential workers and also workers of color during this pandemic?
I think it just shows this huge gap in who is able to access care and who is able to get the care that they need and who can't. She started feeling symptoms last year. She was actively kind of hiding her symptoms, ignoring them for more than 6 months because she was afraid, because she had to keep working. And that, to me, just speaks volumes as to what's wrong with the way things are happening right now in our society.
What has that 6 months cost her?
Unfortunately, at this point, her cancer has metastasized. So it's gone, spread beyond her breast to her hip and to her bones and to her lymph nodes. What Dr. Khosla told me is that if she would have come in 6 months earlier, she likely would have undergone chemo and surgery and been done. But now she's incurable.
It's not just the sort of Teresas of the country who are being harmed by this right now. When we think about the preventative screenings or the long-lasting effects that the pandemic could have on care or even on research, what have you learned?
Unfortunately, this is going to result in a devastating toll. Loss of life and just the ripple effects that it will have on families. You know, the story also looks a lot at Teresa's son, Sergio, who...
An aspiring doctor,
yes, who, you know, who graduated college and had, you know, was pre-med, had all these plans to go to medical school, but he put his life on hold to come back and help with the bills. And then the pandemic hit. And so, you know, he said, I'll wait a little bit longer. And then his mom got sick. And now he doesn't know when he'll be able to start back up that process of becoming a doctor and going to medical school. So unfortunately, it's so far reaching. And in terms of, you know, research and cancer progress, we had made so much progress in this country when it came to reducing cancer mortality. There had been a drop of 31% in cancer death rates from 1991 to 2018. And now the fear is all of that is going to be pushed back because the focus shifted. I mean, I talked to oncologists who said that they had their grants that that were in the pipeline for cancer research, you know, get canceled because that money was shifting to COVID research.
Hmm. So it's not just a question of care, but also that the singular focus on COVID has sort of crowded out the funding for thinking about how we treat cancer in the future.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, what we know about cancer is that, you know, this is a field that with research, I mean, we're constantly learning more. We're constantly coming up with new drugs and new treatment options. So that's another lingering effect that's going to cost us in the long run.
You know, I am someone who, frankly, has put off my own mammogram during this. And I think it's understandable that people might be nervous about going to the doctor, going to a hospital. If someone is listening to this and thinking, oh, man, I probably do need to make this appointment, what should they know and what do experts say about, you know, the risks of COVID versus the risks of going undiagnosed?
I'll tell you what I heard from every single oncologist and public health expert that I spoke to for this story, which is don't delay care. During the very beginning of the pandemic, nobody knew, you know, what this was. This was a new virus. Nobody knew, you know, how it was really being transmitted, what the risks were. But now people understand, and hospitals and doctors' offices have taken safety precautions to really protect people from COVID. And as one oncologist put it to me, it's much safer now to go into a doctor's office than it is to have cancer unknowingly growing inside of you.
Dua El-Deeb, an investigative reporter for ProPublica, wrote this incredible story. Dua, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Next up, we'll hear a conversation from our resident dating expert, Matt Katz, about how relationships have and have not changed during the pandemic.
Back in the early 2000s, you might be surprised to learn that I, now a news reporter at WNYC, had a popular nationally syndicated dating column based out of the newspaper I worked at in New Jersey. There were even three billboards, maybe four, in southern New Jersey with my oversized face advertising the column, which was called The Bachelor Pad. The pad being my notepad, get it? As I covered the seismic changes in dating at the turn of the century, particularly due to the internet. The billboard read, "Get a date with Matt Katz." 13 years of blissful marriage and two kids later, I still think about how relationships and sex and technology intersect. And now this retired dating columnist wonders, what has the pandemic meant for our romantic relationships and sex lives? What's going to change in all of that as the number of fully vaccinated people continues to rise? Will the coming months be a hot vax summer or summer of love, like social media might have you believe? Or are people more interested in finding a partner instead of hooking up? Let's talk about it. With me is Dr. Amanda Gesselman, Associate Director for Research at Indiana University's Kinsey Institute. The Kinsey Institute recently unveiled the results of a national survey looking at the impact of COVID-19 on people's relationships and sex lives. Amanda, glad to have you with us.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I'm curious, because there's been so many jokes and memes about, quote, shot girl summer. But your research shows that people aren't exactly looking for hookups this summer, right? Why is commitment actually hot right now?
Well, people have been stuck in their house for over a year, and a lot of people have been socially isolated, which is, has evolutionarily and historically been very hard for us to psychologically tolerate. So people are really very much looking for connection, for that emotional connection, that intimate connection. And our survey showed that. So we did survey 2,000 people at the end of January. This was in combination or collaboration, I should say, with the magazines Cosmo and Esquire. And we surveyed people about what they're looking for in terms of love and sex after the pandemic, which is what everyone wants to know, basically. Mm-hmm. But we were really interested in especially whether or not people would be, like you said, like once the pandemic, the threat sort of, you know, fades out or abates, are people just going to go out and have lots of sex? Are people looking for, you know, that whole wax and vax thing. Are people looking for lots of sex, but no real commitment? And we didn't find that at all. So of our sample, 44% of people, so almost half of people, said that committed relationships are more important to them now than they were before the pandemic. And these are single, so these are what people are seeking out. So almost half of them said that they're even more important to them now than they used to be, while only 14% said that they're less important to them than they used to be. And on the flip side, we also asked, of course, about, you know, seeking out a variety of sex partners, and only 15% of people said that that idea that, you know, sexual variety, going out and finding the, you know, casual sex, only 15% of people said that that was more important to them now than it was before the pandemic. And only about 20% of people said that it was equally important.
So interesting. And what about how comfortable people are feeling dating right now? What does your research show about that? Is the comfort level trending upward as more and more people get vaccinated?
Yeah, so it seems that more and more people are definitely ready to date. People are sort of, you know, we've all had enough of this, I think. Yes. But especially people who, you know, who were trying to date before, or were trying to find a partner or a connection before, and then had that completely just destroyed with the pandemic. People are ready to get out there. You know, the majority of our participants are telling us that they're ready to date, that they've, you know, already been scoping out the online apps, that they've been, you know, chatting with partners, video chatting, and they're definitely ready to get back into the in-person dating. So I think that we're probably going to see a big rush of that once it's safe to do so.
And are people worried about social anxiety or exposure to COVID? I mean, the fears might be a little bit different than normally, right? I mean, you don't get the same sort of butterflies that you might on a first date. There's all kinds of other worries maybe circling in the back of your head.
Yeah, there's a lot of competition for what to worry about now, I think, and which isn't great. But, you know, this is an unprecedented time. We're all struggling with it. And so I think a lot of people are struggling with their own concerns without thinking about how everyone is also struggling with this. But of course, we ask them what they're worried about when they go back to the dating market, or, you know, they get back out there. And we found that the number one concern for all age groups, men and women, all sexual orientations, et cetera, the number one was finding someone who wants commitment. That was over 1 in 10 people said that was their number one concern, just being able to find someone who wants what they want. And that is a big concern, because before the pandemic, we know that most people weren't telling other people what kind of relationship they wanted, especially in online dating, which is the primary way to meet partners for basically all demographics now. So people were using these online dating services, but no one was ever telling anyone what kind of relationship they wanted. Do you want casual sex? Do you want a hookup? Do you want just a date, you know, a few times? Are you looking for a relationship? So this is now people's number one concern, finding someone who wants that commitment. And that seems to be the concern for everyone. With the second one being figuring out how to protect my own mental health. And I think that might come from the idea of being, you know, isolated for a year, and now we have to think about possibly being rejected, you know, getting our hopes up, trying to make those connections, and just having, you know, having people not want that with us, not accept us, or, you know, just generally setting ourselves up for disappointment. So I think a lot of people are also a bit concerned about that as well.
You know, new trends popped up during the pandemic when it comes to dating. Online dating sites offered video dates. You found that a third of women reported sexting during the pandemic, and a majority intend to continue. Are there trends that we saw during the pandemic when it comes to dating that are here to stay?
Yeah, I know that a lot of people have told me in passing that they think video dating is very awkward, but actually a lot of people have tried it during the pandemic. Over 1 in 5 people who were doing online dating were also trying to do some video dates. And of those, over 70% of them said that they want to continue doing them after the pandemic. And from our data that I collected with my colleague, Justin Garcia, we do this every year with Match, the dating company. It's called Singles in America. It's a huge survey every year. And we actually asked them in August, you know, are they, what is it about the video date? Like, what happened? And what was the good part? And people said that it actually provides a really good vibe check or compatibility check. So it's kind of like you know, like the intermediate step between the text-based messaging and whether or not you want to meet them in person. So people are actually reporting that they liked this for that. I think it probably saves a lot of time. And I think it might also sort of relieve a lot of those worries, those anxieties about whether or not you might find that connection or whether or not you might be compatible.
Dr. Amanda Gesselman is the Associate Director for Research at Indiana University's Kinsey Institute. Amanda, thanks for sharing your research with us. Really interesting stuff.
Thank you for having me.
That's the show for today, y'all. Now remember, all week, we're going to be playing some of our favorite takeaway segments, so listen in. But if you want to hear more of our shows, head on over to thetakeaway.org or download our podcast from wherever you download your audio. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway